Security Assistance Agency marked
a patsy in the John F. Kennedy assassination. And whatever his position was, it was definitely not what we have been led to believe it was by the Warren Commission. So, again, rather interesting connection, a rather interesting place for Ed Wilson to find himself back in the late 1950s and early 1960s.
And keep in mind that he was transferred from the U-2 security project right after Powers went down. Now, Prouty, who was Air Force focal point officer and in charge of all CIA operations involving Air Force units, testifies that would testify, that indicated in his book, The Secret Team, that it was almost impossible for the U-2 plane to have been brought down without inside assistance from the secret team, due to the fact that not only was the lack of fuel an unlikely cause, as some suggested that Powers may have been running out of fuel, but he said apparently with the U-2, you can easily see by the wings and the droop of the wings whether or not the plane is fully fueled. But in addition to that, Francis Gary Powers was not sanitized in any of the ways in which a U-2 pilot was normally sanitized. He had all kinds of hard identification on him, linking him with the U.S. military and intelligence establishments. And in addition to that, the U-2 plane flew so high that there were no aircraft or missiles of that time that were capable of bringing it down. So Edwin Wilson is in charge of the security for the U-2, which turned out to be very insecure indeed prior to Francis Gary Powers going down. And as soon as Powers goes down, Wilson is off to greener climes.
And again, not to get too complicated with this, but one of the other things that we also talked about during the Guns of November was the fact that one of the main things that that sent John F. Kennedy into a rage and made him threaten to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces was the Bay of Pigs. Again, not to get too complicated, but Fletcher Prouty also suggested some perhaps internal meddling with the Bay of Pigs operation, which is kind of complicated to get into right now. But interestingly enough, of course, as we have heard to an extent earlier in this broadcast, Ed Wilson was probably the chief, or certainly one of the chief paymasters of the Bay of Pigs operation as well.
Okay, going back to the book Libyan Sandstorm by John K. Cooley, from which Niptuck read you a section earlier, about Edwin Wilson's background. Among the operations he was involved in before he turned his interest to North Africa was the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba by CIA-trained Cuban mercenaries in 1960. Wilson handled procurement of equipment and pay for the invasion force. In that operation, he worked with Theodore G. Shackley, S-H-A-C-K-L-E-Y, one of the key officials in the CIA's clandestine service. According to evidence unearthed by Seymour Hersh, Shackley was of great help to Wilson and Turple later with their Libyan operations for Gaddafi. Okay, so Edwin Wilson basically was, for all intents and purposes, the Bay of Pigs paymaster. He handled procurement of equipment and pay for the invasion force. And keep in mind that Fletcher Prouty, again, Air Force focal point officer, testifies that sabotaging of the air cover for the Bay of Pigs invasion was responsible for its failure, not any action or lack of action on the part of John F. Kennedy. Now, of course, the Cuban exile community has held Kennedy responsible for the Bay of Pigs failure, and anti-Castro Cubans do figure in the cabal that was involved in assassinating John F. Kennedy. And a key figure, in according to Prouty, in the sabotaging of Bay of Pigs, and as well it is, and also in the organized crime plots against Castro reported to have backfired and against Kennedy, we talked about that on Guns of November, was a guy named General Charles P. Cabell. Okay, the same name crops up in connection with both the JFK assassination and the Bay of Pigs sabotaging. So we have Wilson involved with Bay of Pigs, and also U-2, both apparently sabotaged operations, and both cropping up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy as well. Of course, note the long history of association between Edwin Wilson and the anti-Castro Cubans. We saw him associated with Monkey Morales, with the Villa Verde brothers, and others, and it's an association that is going to figure prominently in the course of the broadcast that we're doing here. Okay, now, again, keep in mind the U-2, keep in mind the Bay of Pigs and their connections to JFK assassination, and also recall the AFL-CIO connection that Niptuck brought up to you earlier.
Okay, the next section here is another Jack Anderson thing, just a short thing from Jack Anderson about another rather interesting case. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Tuesday, March 29th, 1983. The article itself is headlined Wilson's Trail. It talks about a bunch of different people that Wilson was in contact with, including Strom, Thurman, and other United States politicians. But there's one little section here that we find significant, at least at the very least interesting, and I'm going to read that to you. It says, one congressman said Wilson, quote, broadly hinted that he was responsible for the whole Che operation. This was a reference to the CIA-trained Cuban exiles who, in 1967, helped Bolivian troops track down and kill Ernesto Che Guevara, Fidel Castro's former comrade in arms. Sources pointed out that at least four Special Forces men, who later worked for Wilson in Libya, had been members of the ultra-secret CIA A-Team that went after Guevara. Each team member wore a gold ring with Che engraved on the inside. Now, we should mention in passing, not only is it interesting to see Ed Wilson crop up yet again in an historically significant case, once again working with the Cuban exiles and with CIA Special Forces, but also in light of the fact that recently we have run across information, which we have aired on One Step Beyond and Hard Rain, to the effect that there are allegations that Klaus Barbie, the Nazi war criminal, the butcher of Lyon, the former Gestapo chief of occupied Lyon, France, was also working, not only at one point working for the CIA, but was also involved in the tracking down and killing of Ernesto Che Guevara. So in light of Klaus Barbie's later involvement, very heavy involvement in the cocaine trade out of Bolivia, his working for intelligence, his connections to such things as the Galen Organization and to Otto Skorzeny, who's going to crop up a little later in this broadcast, and Ed Wilson's claim, and that's all we have at this point, is a claim of involvement in the Che Guevara killing, something to keep in mind for future reference.
Okay, little tendrils sprout out from that, too. Edwin Wilson and Turpel were involved with training, among others, the Red Brigades. And, of course, the Klaus Barbie gang, as we've looked at on these broadcasts in the past, was very much involved with Italian terrorists of the right. And, of course, the question arises is just who do the Red Brigades work for? Are they right-wing terrorists or left-wing? Are they right-wing left-wing terrorists or right-wing provocateur? And the link-up of the Barbie gang with Italian terrorists is something we've talked about in the past. Okay. Now, in addition, we've been looking at Edwin Wilson's connections with some of the major intelligence operations of the past, with U-2, with the Bay of Pigs, with the tracking down and killing of Che Guevara. I noticed that all of these operations occur in the context of anti-communism, which is interesting in light of Wilson and Turpel's aid of leftist terrorist groups such as IRA, Red Brigades, and so forth. Notice that Edwin Wilson and also Frank Turpel crop up in connection with anti-communist operations and indeed the many of the most important intelligence operations undertaken by this country in the last quarter century. Now, before, we were talking about the assassination of Orlando Letelier, and we read an account from a newspaper article of Raul Villaverde, the brother of the late Rafael Villaverde, of Raul Villaverde's claim that basically the investigation of Mr. Quintero and the Villaverde brothers in connection with the Letelier assassination, because they apparently showed up in Washington, D.C. about 3 days before the killing, directly resulted in the Mr. Proper's having following the trail that he did in order to pick up the Orlando Letelier, the killers of Orlando Letelier. Okay, now the question arises here as to just whether or not Edwin Wilson was in any way involved with the Letelier killing. And keep in mind that U.S. intelligence sources kicked about the story that Letelier had been killed by dissident Chilean leftists who were in exile, whereas, and of course, it has now come out that he was, in fact, killed by an amalgam of right-wing interests.
Before we jump into this, I just want to mention one thing. Since we brought up Klaus Barbie and the various Italian right-wing terrorists that he is involved with, and, of course, which we have been pursuing at great length in the cases that revolve around the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II, it should be mentioned that many of the same CIA media assets that have been so prominent in pushing the KGB shot the Pope theory, such as Michael Ledeen, Claire Sterling, William and James Buckley et al., also jumped promptly into the Orlando Letelier case and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and reams of newsprint trying to convince the world that Orlando Letelier was shot by communists to gain sympathy for the communist cause. And all along, the people like Ledeen, Sterling, Buckley had access to information about the case that ordinary laymen and journalists did not have, suggesting that they had some kind of an intelligence contact, perhaps into the George Bush-run CIA at the time they were spreading this disinformation. So bear that in mind also.
Okay, and note that the assassination of Orlando Letelier, when it was being attributed to the left, would have fallen perhaps under the category of political provocation. And of course, provocation is an operation where you perform an act of violence or do something bad and then blame it on your opponent in order to discredit them. Now, the whole question, the crux of the Turple and Wilson case is, here we have all these left-wing terrorists, okay, being aided by the United States, and the question is it or is it not being done in an official capacity? Turple and Wilson's case was that yes, it was, and that they were in fact working for the U.S. government. The government says no, but where we have these two men operating in the context of terrorism, and we see them connected with operations which appear to have been provocations, at least to a certain extent, as the Letelier killing was when it was being blamed on the Chilean left, again, this suggests a certain common thread from Letelier to the IRA to the Red Brigades, Gaddafi, PLO, and so forth. And, of course, the U-2 incident with which Wilson was also connected with was blamed on the Soviets, whereas, as we've seen, that, too, was a political provocation, at least according to Fletcher Prouty. Jack Anderson took up the question of Edwin Wilson's involvement with the Letelier killing. He did it in his column of Tuesday, December 21st of 1982. The San Francisco Chronicle headlined this column, "Did He Know?" Anderson writes as follows. On the morning of September 21st, 1976, ex-CIA agent Edwin Wilson had breakfast at Washington's Mayflower Hotel with an associate and bodyguard who went by the alias of Peter Wagner. Wilson had just returned from Geneva, where he had met with three Cuban CIA agents and, the federal government later charged, had attempted to arrange the assassination of a Libyan dissident. But he said nothing of this to Wagner. But Wilson did ask his associate what he'd be doing that day and where he'd be. Wagner replied, according to a secret House Intelligence Committee transcript, that he would be checking with two private investigators who were on a divorce case stakeout in Northwest Washington. Wilson then leaned forward, Wagner said, quote, and advised me why didn't I stay out of that area and stay in the offices the rest of the day, unquote. But Wagner ignored the advice and drove to the area to give instructions to his agents. By the time he returned to Wilson's office, the radio waves were crackling with the news that a bomb had exploded in a car at Sheridan Circle, just two blocks from where Wagner's agents were stationed. Killed were Chilean exile leader Orlando Letelier and an American co-worker. According to the secret transcripts obtained by my associate Dale Van Atta, Wagner later joined Wilson and several other people for drinks at a local club. The occasion quickly assumed the atmosphere of a victory party. Wilson, Wagner said, quote, was pleased that things turned out the way they did, unquote. Wagner also recalled that he had heard Letelier's name mentioned many times around Wilson's office. Wagner's testimony before the Intelligence Committee once again raises an intriguing question that has hung over the Letelier murder for years. Did Edwin Wilson, who has just been convicted of illegally supplying weapons to agents of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, have advanced knowledge of the plot to kill Letelier? In March of 1977, I reported that anti-Castro Cubans were linked to the Letelier murder. A month later, Bob Woodward of the Washington Post reported a link between Wilson and the Letelier assassination. Federal investigators first denied the allegation, but then decided to interrogate Wilson because of his close ties to Cuban expatriates, with whom he had worked as a CIA official. Footnote: to his attorney, Wilson claimed he had never heard of Letelier prior to his assassination. So, suspicious movements here by Edwin Wilson, warning somebody to stay out of the area in which, as it turned out, Orlando Letelier was to be assassinated later in the day. And that same former agent of Wilson's testified that Wilson and his associates appeared very pleased at a dinner that they were having the night of the killing, and that Orlando Letelier's name cropped up in connection around Wilson's office many times. So again, here we have possible connections of Wilson to yet another major U.S. intelligence operation, and again, one which, at least in its initial stages, was something of a provocation.
Now, the Letelier murder was eventually, though there was much, much messing about with it, the man they eventually pinned it on was a man named Michael Vernon Townley, a.k.a. the Jackal, no relation to Carlos the Jackal, at least not family-wise. Now, one of the things that was glossed over was the fact that Michael Vernon Townley had vast and well-established roots in the CIA. He came from an intelligence family. He was intimately linked to the CIA station in Santiago, Chile. Bear in mind that George Bush was head of the CIA at the time that the investigation of the Letelier assassination was going on. The CIA got off scot-free after three or four counter stories had been floated. First, as we mentioned earlier, that the assassins were leftists. Then that they were anti-Castro Cubans. Finally, that they were working for DINA, Chilean Secret Police. Never was it actually pinned on the CIA. A situation we've seen before called Modified Limited Hangout. Now, bear in mind that George Bush was one of the people that Ed Wilson's lawyer wanted to subpoena as witnesses. Another one was Major General Richard Secord, in charge of Deputy Defense Chairman, I guess it was, for Southeast Asia and related places. We're going to hear about something that might perhaps suggest why he was being asked to appear or was being threatened with a subpoena, I guess as the case may be. In an interview with Frank Turple in Penthouse magazine from December of 1983, and it goes as follows, the small section we're reading from right now. Penthouse asks, "Okay, while we're talking about Miami, let's talk a bit about the controversies that have surrounded the Miami CIA station." Turple, "The significance of Miami is the drug syndicate. Miami's the base. The people that I hired from the agency to terminate other people are there." In parentheses, Turple, giving names, then alleged that two former highly placed CIA officers were responsible for the following scheme. "They got involved in this big drug scandal, which was whitewashed. Where do the drugs come from? Laos. Where did the money come from? Nguyen Hand Bank." In parentheses, "Amid allegations of corruption and international drug traffic, the Nguyen Hand Bank, a Far East bank with branches worldwide whose officers included many ranking members of the U.S. intelligence establishment, went bankrupt in 1981. Continuing with Turple, "The idea was, in the Golden Triangle of Laos, you had to buy warlords. How do you do that? You gave them more money than the going market rate for their product. Now, what do? You sell the opium through Singapore, Hong Kong, and Delhi. You reinvest the profits in your own operations. The money is brought to Kabul and deposited in the First National City Bank of Afghanistan. The other bank was Nguyen Hand. That's where the transfers went. Now you've got an accelerated fund. Now you've got all this goddamned money. And what do? With it? You pay it to Alice Springs, Australia, the site of a huge military intelligence installation. Billions of dollars. Not millions. Billions of dollars. More money than you knew what the hell to do with." Penthouse, "So you're saying that the agency would provide gold, which would then be flown into the Golden Triangle." Turple, "To pay for the drugs." Penthouse, "And these would then be sold in any of three cities and the money put into different banks?" Turple, "Then farmed back into the agency accounts." Penthouse, "Into the operations in Alice Springs?" Turple, "Right. A lot of money." Okay, now a couple of things to mention very quickly about the Nguyen Hand Bank. The Nguyen Hand Bank, as they mention here, was an intelligence bank. All the board of directors, the ranking officers, were all people with prominent military or intelligence backgrounds. It fell under very bizarre circumstances and all kinds of bizarre stories, which I don't know if we're going to have time to get into tonight. But anyway, many indications. Now, if it were just Frank Turple's word, admittedly a wanted criminal, a renegade CIA agent, or whatever he might be, perhaps not somebody you'd necessarily want to believe. However, regular listeners to our show will know that we have run across things verifying most of the things he says here in many other sources, including Pennyler News book In Banks We Trust, in the book The Great Heroin Coup, which we're going to be reading from also a little later tonight, and in many other sources. Heroin, the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia, and all kinds of seminal works on the subject, as well as numerous newspaper articles. He is, in fact, talking about a well-known route that when the French Connection, the previous drug route mostly run by the Corsican Mafia and others, was overthrown, literally overthrown, by the Nixon administration DEA, the heroin trade was changed from the Golden to the Golden Triangle area, and then into South America and up into the United States, and the CIA began taking a serious cut out of it, and other organizations, presumably, began taking a serious cut out of it to finance clandestine operations that they couldn't get financed through money provided by the taxpayers. So that's what Turple's talking about, and that perhaps, again, is what he's looking after C-Corp for, but we don't know.
Okay, so keep in mind now, with the Nugenhand Bank, basically it's an operation run by the U.S. intelligence community and military. It basically serves as a number of purposes. First of all, it serves as the reservoir for the funds to be used in the massive drug trafficking engaged in by the intelligence community, and the profits from that traffic then plowed back into the agency and used to support intelligence operations, as Turple indicated. And I would add that documentation on this comes from many other sources other than Frank Turple. There was an excellent series of articles in the Wall Street Journal in August of 1982 by a man named Jonathan Quitney. Okay. And we're going to read you a section from one of his books a little later. But the Nugenhand Bank also served as a major conduit for the arms traffic. The payments for many lucrative arms deals were involved with Nugenhand, including Edwin Wilson, as we're going to touch on in a second. And it should also be noted that the Nugenhand Bank was used as a funding conduit for the overthrow of the government of Gough Whitlam in Australia. Whitlam had been opposed to U.S. policy in Vietnam and was also going to close down the U.S., a very important U.S. intelligence station at Pine Gap in Australia. So the CIA, basically operating through Nugenhand, successfully destabilized the Whitlam government in Australia. Now, one of the most interesting things about the Nugenhand Bank is the fact that it was sort of a joint operation between the CIA and something called Task Force 157, and that's one of the elements touched on by Ed Wilson when his lawyer was casting about for the list of witnesses that Nip Tuck talked about a little earlier. The Task Force 157 was this top-secret naval intelligence operation which involved, among other things, the Nugenhand Bank. Now, for our purposes, it's interesting to note here that Task Force 157, of which Edwin Wilson was an important part and of which involved the Nugenhand Bank, was run by none other than then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Okay, that information and some other things about Nugenhand was carried in a book called, a book Nip Tuck referred to just a second ago, a book called In Banks We Trust. That was authored by Penny Lernoux, last name L-E-R-N-O-U-X. And Lernoux's In Banks We Trust was copyrighted in 1984 and published by Doubleday, okay, by the Anchor Press, which is a subsidiary of Doubleday. Now, the association of Edwin Wilson, Henry Kissinger, and Task Force 157, including the Nugenhand Bank, Lernoux writes as follows. In addition to drugs, Nugenhand was involved in various arms deals with Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Brazil, and the White Rhodesian government of Ian Smith. The bank also did business with Edwin Wilson, the former CIA agent convicted in the United States of selling explosives to Libya and charged with supplying trained men, arms, and technology to Libya and other military buyers. Memos and testimony by Nugenhand employees show that Hand met with Wilson in Bangkok and that Houghton, that's Bernie Houghton, a key official and former CIA agent involved with Nugenhand, and that Houghton held discussions with him in Switzerland. Intelligence sources also claim that Houghton used Nugenhand's Saudi Arabian branch to finance Wilson's arms smuggling operations. In view of such activities, one might ask why so many high-ranking U.S. military men lent their names and prestige to the bank. Part of the answer may lie in the U.S. intelligence community's obvious ties to Nugenhand. While Colby and Admiral Yates denied any connection between the CIA and the bank, General Black was not so sure. I'm not saying it's not possible, he allowed, but I certainly wasn't aware of it. Walter McDonald, a Nugenhand consultant and former CIA deputy director, was also uncertain. I really don't see it happening, but I can't vouch for it. Technically, they may have been correct, since the bank apparently was originally part of a deep cover intelligence operation known as Task Force 157, which worked with the CIA, but was controlled by the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence, and was directly responsible to strong-willed Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The task force gained notoriety when 21 of its former agents took the Navy to court to demand civil service benefits after the group was abruptly disbanded in 1977 because of some unknown internal scandal. Ed Wilson had a desk and his own staff at the task force's Washington headquarters and is credited with supplying the operation's front name, Pierce Morgan. Informed sources said that Task Force 157 used the Nugenhan Bank for covert naval intelligence money, just as the CIA used it to undermine Australia's Labor government. So not only does Edwin Wilson use the bank as a funding conduit for his own arms trafficking, but apparently he was also very much involved with Task Force 157, also Nugenhan connected, and he apparently supplied the Task Force 157 with its name. And remember, that operation run by Henry Kissinger, and Edwin Wilson very much involved with it. Again, one of the many powerful people in Washington to whom the strings that Kevin Mulcahy referred to go.
All right. The next section is we talk about the continuing career, checkered career of Ed Wilson, is another reading from the book Libyan Sandstorm by John Cooley. This is just a short segment here, but it talks about some connections to some people that who are still in positions of power to this day, not that many of them probably aren't. It says as follows, after the Bay of Pigs, Wilson helped establish a new Washington firm called Consultants International, Incorporated, otherwise known as CI, a front for CIA and U.S. naval intelligence activities. It was during this period, according to federal investigators, that Wilson and his associates were able to earn benefits well in excess of their salaries from commissions and kickbacks by exporting U.S. security and intelligence technology. One of Wilson's fellow board members on Consultants International was the leading Republican public relations man, Robert Keith Gray, who was chairman of Ronald Reagan's inaugural committee. Gray denied ever knowing that Wilson was on the CI board, but said he found Wilson charming and very much, quote, a red-blooded American. Okay, so we have, apparently Robert Keith Gray would like us to believe that both he and Ed Wilson were on the board of directors of Consultants International, and that Robert Keith Gray saw him often enough to know he was charming and a real red-blooded American, but in fact didn't know anything much about him, and certainly didn't know that he was on the board of directors along with him. Well, you can take that with any size grain of salt you want to. I would just like to mention that you're listening to...
mind that Robert Keith Gray is one of the most important figures in the Republican Party today. He also has a lot of connections with Democrats, too, but primarily Republicans, and that's where his lot has been cast with at this point. But Robert Keith Gray is very much involved with the Reagan administration and has, obviously, he's worked with Edwin Wilson, and he was the fellow who arranged Reagan's inaugural ceremonies, and we'll come back to those inaugural ceremonies in the future. But just keep in mind the name Robert Keith Gray and his association with Edwin Wilson. Gray is one of the real luminaries in Washington today. I'd like to go back and touch on another name that we brought up in connection with the expiring witnesses in the Triple Wilson case. Now, one of the fellows who was deep-sixed under rather strange circumstances was a man named Waldo Duberstein. Recall that Duberstein died of a shotgun blast hours before he was to be indicted for supplying top-secret Defense Intelligence Agency information to Wilson. Now, going back to the article from Penthouse, in which Jim Hogan interviews Frank Turple, Penthouse asks Turple, okay, let's move on to Libya. You stated at one time that the first Libyan attempt to invade Chad took place on the basis of information that came indirectly through the agency. Can you elaborate? Turple. Wilson and I were in Libya. No big secret. Gaddafi entertained thoughts about invading Chad. However, Gaddafi had no knowledge of two key factors. One, would France come to the aid of Chad? Two, what were the capabilities of Chad's army and air force? Wilson was hired to provide what is called an Order of Battle Plan, or OB Plan. It's a complete capability breakdown of troop strength, morale, physical capabilities, weak spots, and strong spots. Wilson knew, and I knew, that it was impossible to obtain this except through the Defense Intelligence Agency of the CIA. Wilson went to a high-level CIA officer to see if he could assemble an OB, knowing full well where the CIA officer would go to obtain the information. The officer was paid $50,000 for the OB. Now, this man, who is not an expert in these affairs at all, had to rely on the help of people who work with this on a daily basis. one of whom was Waldo Duberstein. Duberstein, unfortunately, had a hunting accident in the laundry room of his girlfriend's apartment. And so that basically tells you a little bit about what Mr. Duberstein had to do with Turple and Wilson and why maybe certain people did not want him there to testify at the trial, that he provided top-secret information to them from the highest levels of the U.S. intelligence community, again, this order of battle plan. And the question is, who sanctioned that? Okay, and keep in mind that Mr. Duberstein, Mr. Mulcahy, and all the rest went out by other than natural causes, just as they were to figure in the Turple Wilson trials.
That's right. Okay, two more short articles, and then we're going to take a break. So just to let you know, if you're starting to feel a little twitchy in the back and legs, that in just a moment we're going to have another break. Okay, this next section is also out of the Penthouse interview from December 1983 with Frank Turple. And as Dave mentioned, James Hogan is the interviewer. Okay, this section just further details some of the other interesting contacts, brings Kevin Mulcahy briefly back into the picture, and mentions somebody that we mentioned very briefly earlier in the show as somebody else who is might possibly be interested in the developments of the Wilson case. Very short section. Penthouse. It's been alleged by Jack Anderson that the Justice Department was investigating statements that payments were made secretly to Senator Strom Thurmond by a middleman acting for Ed Wilson. Could you tell us about that? Turple. The courier who testified about dropping the money was Kevin Mulcahy. He worked for both Wilson and me. He stated that the drop was made to another courier, a prominent Washington socialite, in front of the passport office on 14th and K. Mulcahy would give him an attaché case, and the payments were in increments of $4,000. Penthouse. Not a pretty picture.
So basically we have Kevin Mulcahy acting as the funding conduit between Wilson and yet another one of these people to whom those strings go, the powerful South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, one of the real linchpins of the doctrinaire right in this country today. Yet another prominent right-wing figure who's been very much involved with the Washington scene for some time, in fact, was the central figure in a major scandal, a Koreagate scandal, also ties in with Ed Wilson. Again, going back to the Penthouse interview from which Nip and I have been reading you. Penthouse, let's talk a bit about Ed Wilson. Did he know the Korean Tongson Park? Turple, yes. When Park disappeared into London, Wilson had all the unlisted phone numbers and was in direct communication with him on many, many occasions. Penthouse, Park, of course, was a KCIA agent. Turple, of course. Penthouse, and Wilson was a CIA agent. Turple, yes. Penthouse, it was alleged, among other things, that Park was involved in possible bribery of certain congressmen. Was the agency aware of this? Turple, I don't see how they could not be aware of it. Wilson was one of the original members of the Georgetown Club. He was also a charter member of the University Club. None of this was arranged for him through his own introductions. Penthouse, then through whom? Turple, the company, the agency. The agency gave Wilson this profile of having all this money and stuff. And all this money and everything else. Okay, so yet another prominent contact of Ed Wilson's. Tongson Park, again, the central figure in the Korean Koreagate scandal in which American congressmen were being investigated in connection with having received gifts from Korea and specifically the KCIA through Tongson Park and the Moonies. And that basically this concerned, you know, foreign influence buying in the United States government. And interestingly enough, the special prosecutor for Koreagate was a fellow by the name of Leon Jaworski, who was not only head of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit, but also he was, we've looked at Leon Jaworski in the past on these broadcasts. Jaworski was the member of the Warren Commission in charge with researching whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald had intelligence connections, and then, of course, he turned up as the Watergate special prosecutor after Archibald Cox was removed from office, and the connections between Watergate and the JFK assassination we've talked about in the past. So yet another link, another tendril going from the Wilson Turple milieu to the assassination of President Kennedy. So, again, look at all the powerful people and important operations that Wilson and Turple connect up with. We've got Edwin Wilson hooked up with Bay of Pigs, the U2 operation, the killing of Che Guevara, the Letelier assassination, quite possibly. We've got them hooked up with Tongson Park, Strom Thurmond, got them connected with the Nugenhand Bank. George Bush was director of CIA at that point. You've got them hooked up at Task Force 157, Henry Kissinger, Robert Keith Gray, and all kinds of other people. The point is that and at Thomas Kleins, the director of covert operations for the CIA, involved with Turple and Wilson and their many corporate fronts, an awful lot of very important names and important operations. And note that Turple and Wilson's careers go to basically characterized by fierce doctrinaire anti-communism, and all of a sudden we find them working with alleged left-wing or perhaps actual left-wing terrorists. Again, the waters get pretty muddied here, but you want to be asking yourselves how that comes to be.
Yes, the most important point, I think, in all of that is that at the same time we're told that they're selling weapons to left-wing terrorists, they are still consorting and intimately involved with prominent right-wing anti-communist figures who don't seem to bat an eye at the fact that these cohorts of theirs are at the same time selling weapons to the PLO and the Red Brigades, etc., etc. Don't seem to bat an eye. This from Strom Thurmond, you know, who is somewhere to the right of Genghis Khan, doesn't seem to bother him at all, according to some people, to take money from Ed Wilson and etc., etc. So, again, and the other thing to look at is that these supposed ex-CIA agents, anybody who can find a break in the substance of these people's careers between the time they were CIA agents and the time they were allegedly ex-CIA agents, I congratulate you if you can find a difference in the kinds of activities they've been perpetrating or the kinds of effects these activities have had. Well, anyway, I think that sums up where we're going to stop for now, just for a few minutes. We're going to take a break, a little bit under 5 minutes, and then we're going to be back for the final information segment. Should be the final information segment of tonight's Radio Free America. And after we finish this, probably about another 40, 45 minutes or so, we will be trying to answer some phone calls. What we're going to be examining next, and we're going to start off with a long article, which I'll explain in a moment, is to go a little deeper into perhaps some of the motivations, some of the possible motivations behind the activities of Wilson and Turple, if they are, as we will find out, as they have been alleged to be, in fact, still working or connected with U.S. intelligence in some shape or form. Obviously, there would be questions about this. What good would their selling guns and weapons to Libya do, working for Idi Amin, et cetera, if it wasn't purely for personal profit? And why would they be able to do these kind of things with full knowledge of the CIA and get away with it? What benefit would accrue to the CIA or to people in the CIA, not necessarily America at large, as I don't think a lot of us would necessarily feel that selling Muammar Gaddafi guns is a real good idea. Okay, one of the first segment we're going to take is a long article, a long segment of a long article from Gung Ho Magazine. Now, Gung Ho Magazine is a mercenary magazine. So first off, obviously it is not quite as staid a source as we oftentimes use. However, a couple of things do have to be mentioned. First of all, Gung Ho is a right-wing magazine. Gung Ho is not a leftist rag of some sort. So many people would suggest that the point of view that we are taking, although we strongly resist that the name, but is from a sort of a left-leaning point of view. It's obviously anti-right-wing, anti-fascist. Anyway, Gung Ho is a right-wing magazine to begin with. Second of all, the article itself is well-written, as you will see as we read through it. Thirdly, virtually nothing that's been said in this Gung Ho Magazine article has not been said somewhere else. I guess is what I'm trying to say. One thing is that this Gung Ho Magazine puts it all into fairly compact form, which makes it easier to deal with. All of the really significant things are quotes from people involved. Okay, so it's not just the writer of the magazine for the magazine making these things up as they go along. So anyway, that being the case.
I just take note that a lot of times some of these mercenary publications, and again, Gung Ho is similar in scope and function to Soldier of Fortune, but you get a lot of these intelligence and military insiders sort of letting their hair down, and that is the real value of this article, is you have statements about what Turple and Wilson were doing with Gaddafi and why the CIA was supporting them, and they were in fact CIA, coming from people who were not only involved with Turple and Wilson, but real insiders in this whole situation, and so it's a very valuable article.
And speaking to what they believe will be a sympathetic audience also, which is also necessary to understand.
Again, this is from Gung Ho of June of 1982.
That's right. Okay, starting in the middle of the article. Then there is Theodore Shackley, the former number two in the CIA's clandestine services, who says he retired in 1979. Interestingly, back in the mid-1970s, when Theodore Shackley was operating the agency's clandestine services, he was using one of the CIA's former agents as a, quote, back-channel intelligence source, as that man plied his international trade as a, quote, business consultant to various foreign governments friendly to the U.S. That ex-agent's name? Edwin P. Wilson, of you-know-what and whom fame. Their ties, meaning Shackley's and Wilson's, go deep, socially and professionally. However, when asked by federal prosecutors allegedly investigating the Wilson-Turple case, Shackley told them CIA rules prohibited him from commenting on anything relating to his CIA career, including his relationship with Wilson. Tame congressional investigators, led by the CIA insider in charge, went no further in asking questions. Since his retirement, Shackley has served as a consultant to several international brokerage houses doing business in world trouble spots. The firms that hired Shackley were either organized by or funded with Wilson's assistance. Shackley denies anything being wrong with this relationship, saying that another close CIA colleague, Thomas G. Kleins, actually hired him, rather than Wilson. As of September 1981, Shackley was still listed as a, quote, consultant to several of Klein's firms, which operate out of Rosslyn, Virginia, which is a next-door neighbor to CIA headquarters. At present, Shackley is an advisor to a number of oil company clients and their host country officials. His special area of expertise is political instability and counterinsurgency efforts in the Arab world, all of which brings to mind Ed Wilson and Frank Turple. Wilson remains an enigma, while Turple is an open, outgoing realist whose pragmatic sense of humor is an outrage to many people involved in the CIA and American foreign policy. Wilson and Turple were indicted by a federal grand jury in April 1980 for various violations, including their alleged theft and shipment of at least 20 tons of C4 high-explosive time-delay fuses, night vision sniping equipment, plus myriad other paramilitary hardware to Libya. They were also named as the team leaders in a multi-million dollar hit plot to silence critics of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. I met Turple once and considered him as a face value person. Many insiders, though, feel he is still associated with the CIA. However, his November appearance on the CBS show 60 Minutes surely added to the CIA's corporate black eye for hypocritical mistruth. In any case, perhaps the professional backgrounds of Wilson and Turple would be useful case histories for someone currently working in intelligence or the military who is looking for a second or, quote, retirement career as an executive-level mercenary. Edwin P. Wilson was a highly regarded agent who was heavily involved in the Bay of Pigs operation. His specialty was the creation of dummy companies and corporate cutouts, through which funds, arms, explosives, and other equipment could be covertly supplied to CIA field agents and their assets abroad. He was well known among the intelligence community of the Caribbean and the Middle East, building his personal and professional contacts with an eye for operating in the future, with continued agency support, of course. Turple was a communications and electronics expert for the agency, although he also liked to dabble in weapons and explosives. He worked in the Middle East and in India. He was supposedly, quote, fired from the CIA in the 1970s because of, quote, irregular behavior regarding company funds. He then became one of the world's major gunrunners, selling both surplus and new military ordnance all over the globe, also, obviously, with at least tacit CIA approval. The two became business partners in 1976, operating primarily in the Middle East, usually with third world nations which had shaky diplomatic relations with the United States. They operated at the top levels of these governments and movements as executive level mercenaries whose continued ties to the CIA gave the U.S. a good hedge on all bets in those troubled lands. Okay, real quickly, let me go back over that and reiterate that, because this is an important part toward understanding one possible explanation for Turple and Wilson's behavior. The two became business partners in 1976, primarily in the Middle East, usually with third world nations which had shaky diplomatic relations with the United States. That would cover the ball for Libya, Uganda, and some of these other places quite well. as well as the PLO, which, while not a nation, are certainly a nation in exile and have definitely shaky diplomatic relations with the United States. They operated at the top levels of these governments and movements as executive-level mercenaries whose continued CIA ties gave the U.S. a good hedge on all bets in those troubled lands. So, again, after reviewing all the information, after reviewing the raft of corpses that turned up when Ed Wilson's trial came up, after he had threatened to shut the gates of the CIA front and back if they brought him to trial, many of the prominent people who could have linked Ed Wilson and his activities to a continuing relationship with the CIA turned up dead. We've been looking at the various high-level connections of Ed Wilson to people still prominent and involved in the CIA, including Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, and his connections to people like Strom Thurmond, or allegations of connections to people like Strom Thurmond and others, and his various cases that he was involved in. Perhaps we can begin to at least look at why they might indeed still be connected to the intelligence community.
Okay, now several things in that passage are worth taking note of before we move on, because we have a lot of other information from this gung-ho article. First of all, take note of the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which are the, I believe it was the House, congressional investigators. We've referred several times to congressional investigations of the Turple Wilson case, and it doesn't say which House. The gung-ho article doesn't say J. David Truby, doesn't say which House investigation was involved with, but he says basically that a CIA insider controlled the course of the congressional investigation of Turple and Wilson, so they basically wouldn't find anything. Take note of the fact that, as Truby says, Theodore Shackley, who was very much involved with Turple and with Edwin Wilson in the Bay of Pigs, that Theodore Shackley admits to having used Turple and Wilson as an intelligence source after they supposedly left the agency. Take note of the fact that Theodore Shackley, after his own retirement, went to work for some corporate fronts which were set up and funded by Edwin Wilson. Take note also of the fact that the association between Thomas Kleins and Theodore Shackley, because Thomas Kleins, again, was the number one in the CIA's clandestine services, whereas Truby refers to Shackley as the number two, and both of them are very much involved with Turple and Wilson in the corporate fronts that they used for, among other things, their Libyan operation. Okay, very, very important thing to take note of. And also note the fact that apparently, according to Truby, Frank Turple must have continued to operate with CIA when he was involved with his arms business, and of course the passage which Nip Tuck just noted for you there, that the Turple Wilson team operated, as do other CIA teams, in countries which have shaky diplomatic relations with the United States. Okay, there may be other